This is Authors in Focus.
Hi, I'm Michael Levin. I'm a writer, publisher, and author publicist. Looking for a fun satirical read? Check out The Cider and Ale Chronicles, written by myself and JMD Reed, now available on Amazon. And get ready for Max and the Captain, available early March 2022. Today, I'm joined by Craig Deegan, author of The Cracklock Saga. Welcome to the Authors in Focus podcast. Today we're here with Craig Deegan, author of The Cracklock Saga. First book in that series is called Fae or Foe. It's absolutely fantastic. How are you doing today, Craig?
Yeah, really good, thanks. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing all right. We are in a lockdown, or what I would say is a phase two lockdown, I guess. They haven't completely shut down everything yet, but they've shut down movie theaters, restaurants, gyms. Grocery stores are at half capacity, and my kids are doing online school.
Oh, that sucks. We've managed to avoid it so far in the UK here, it has to be said. We were kind of expecting it after Christmas, but the booster program seems to be the way forward that the government are favouring. So, we're all still, everything's pretty much as it was. We have to wait.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing that here too, but the numbers are just like out of control. Like we're hitting like between 15 and 18,000 cases a day. So I think the big thing with schools, like having a bunch of kids indoors in one room eating with their masks off and stuff like that, they figured it was better to give it at least a few weeks to see what would happen. But my gut is that they're probably going to keep us online all year. So
we'll try and stay sane anyway.
Yeah, it's all right. You know, it's not that bad for us because we both work from home anyway, my wife and I. So it's made it a little bit easier to adapt because we've kind of had 2 years of ups and downs of this thing happening to be able to do that. But anyway, on top of that, I live in Canada. It's cold. What are you going to do? I always like to start these interviews with a couple of fun questions before we get into more of the writing-related content. So my first question to you, Craig, is if you could have a drink with any author, living or dead, who would it be and why?
Oh, that's very simple for me to answer. It would be Stephen King. Even though he's a horror writer and I write completely different, he's been one of my main inspirations, and I've been a massive fan of him since I first picked up It at the age of 8 and read it that my mother left lying around. I just think he's awesome. The descriptions he puts into his books is brilliant. His earlier stuff, I think, is kind of better than the later stuff. There have been some gems in the later stuff, but yeah, and I collect his first edition hardbacks as well, so it would have to be Cy King, I'm afraid.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan. I went through a period where I needed to own every single one of his books, and even the super long later ones that I knew I would probably never get to just because I didn't have time, but I still wanted to have them on my shelf because I love his stuff so much. One of my favorite things about Stephen King is his way of getting into the characters' heads and the whole psychological inner monologue stuff. And stream of consciousness writing that goes into his work, which I've actually adapted a lot into my own writing, or attempted to. And also the way he ties all his worlds together into the whole Dark Tower universe. I don't know, have you read, I'm assuming you've read the Dark Tower.
Oh yes, I've read them all. The Dark Tower is one of my favourites of all time. I particularly like, you know, the things, the spin-offs from it, you know, the Eyes of the Dragon.
Yep.
The fact that, you know, the guy from Salem's Lot appears in it later on, you know, the priest that was burnt by the vampire. So yeah, it's the Gunslinger epic, the whole Dark Tower thing was an incredible work of fantasy, I thought. I mean, they've got the things like the Wind Through the Keyhole and stuff like that that's kind of spun off from it as well. So it certainly influenced my writing, reading his stuff. Just really more the character side, the character development side, where he's very descriptive in the way that he writes. He's certainly a show-not-tell kind of guy.
Right. No, definitely. And four of the books in the series I wrote with James are basically portal fantasies. They're kind of satirical portal fantasies, very much influenced, at least on my end, by The Drawing of the Three and the whole Stephen King bringing himself in, that metatextual element that happened, I think, in maybe Song of Susanna, if I'm remembering correctly, the fifth book. Like, I thought that was absolutely brilliant, and that was also influential in writing myself and James into our books as actual characters. So, yeah, very, very cool answer. He's definitely up there for me. I would probably choose James Joyce first, even though I would probably have a slightly easier time with Stephen King. definitely, he would definitely be high on my list. Okay, so the next question is, I don't really like to use the word guilty pleasures when it comes to media and movies and books and stuff like that, because I think there's a lot of stuff out there and everybody is free to like what they like. But if there was something in the media, so either, a movie, a TV show, a book series or something like that, that people would be really surprised that you were actually a fan of, what would that be?
Oh, that's a very good question. I don't know. I kind of watch the popular stuff on TV, the TV shows. I've just literally today finished the last episode of the latest series of Cobra Kai. So that's really more of a teen romp, I think, but I really enjoy it from the old Karate Kid kind of days. Movies wise that I may have liked. Not really. I'm kind of straight down the line with stuff like that. I like the Marvel Universe, the DC Universes and the horror stuff, really. There's nothing that I would think is a particular guilty pleasure. I've got quite an eclectic reading mix and collection. That's a difficult one for me to answer, I must say, because I don't think there's anything that I could... I'm kind of straight up. There's nothing really that I would watch or think, oh, you know, if somebody found out about this, they may laugh at me. But I do watch the cartoons with the kids. Right. Pokemon, I suppose that may be something. I know more about Pokemon since my lad got into it than I've ever wished to know.
Yeah, well, that's the age. It's weird. Like, I have a 9-year-old daughter who's not into it at all. She's into a lot of the teen books, though, you know, like those teen book series and Series of Unfortunate Events and stuff like that, which was actually a really brilliant TV show on Netflix as well. My son is 7 and he's not quite into, never got into Pokemon either, but I definitely know, through my daughter's friends and stuff that there are a lot of kids, especially boys that age, that are really into that. So definitely know what that's like. For me, as far as something that I go on a lot about that, I guess, so M. Night Shyamalan is not quite as fashionable as he was around the time that Sixth Sense and Unbreakable came out. But he did a movie with James McAvoy called Split, which is one of his newer movies. It was actually the second in the Unbreakable trilogy, because there was a movie that came out after called Glass that had Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson in it. But it's basically about a guy that has multiple personalities, and some of them are really nice and some of them are absolutely terrifyingly evil. And his performance was so mind-blowing that I actually say, like, he should have gotten I know it's a Shyamalan movie, but he should have been up for an Oscar for this role because it was absolutely brilliant. And that's kind of the movie that I throw in everybody's face and people say, really, Shyamalan? I see dead people or whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, that is a movie that's on my to-watch list. I have seen it advertised. I knew about McAvoy. So I haven't seen it yet. I didn't realize it was part of that set of movies that he did.
It is.
Unbreakable, it's obviously Glass, but I didn't realize that was part of that universe. So
Glass was okay. It was a little bit too much. They tried to sort of pull too many things into one movie, but Split kind of stood alone the way Unbreakable stood alone. So it's like you've got the two stories and then Glass is the crossover. So I'd recommend both of them for sure. Like, you would want to continue the story, but Split was absolutely mind-blowing. So definitely, if you have been considering watching it, you have my full endorsement. So let's get on to the Cracklock Saga and find out a little bit about you as a writer. I'm interested to know when you decided you wanted to be a writer and a little bit about what led to the publication of the first book in your series.
Yeah, sure. But where to start? I've been a beta reader for a number of years, mainly for it has to be, say, horror, a lot of zombie apocalypse stuff, that kind of thing. And I'd always had this idea for the Cracknogs. The thing that triggered it off was when my daughter was much younger, she had a particular, as kids do, they latch onto a set or a series of books that they really like and they want you to read them all the time. At bedtime, and this particular set, there were fairy books, but there are hundreds of them. I won't name the series because I know that they're very popular, but they're all the same. They're exactly the same story. They follow the exact same structure, regardless of which one you read in. But we had to read these things over and over again, and she must have had sort of 50, 60 of them, and you know, it gets to the point, by the time you're on the sort of the 10th one, you know exactly what's going to happen by the time you've turned over the first page. I really start to dislike these fairies, to be honest with you. And that's what made me start to think, you know, what would somebody do if they didn't like fairies? What could they do about it? And it sort of mulled over in my mind for a while. And I came with this loose fledgling of an idea while I was sort of doing this beta reading. And I saw what the guys were producing, and I kind of thought, well, I write scientific reports all day every day. I thought, well, could I write something? And then in May 2019, I went to Comic-Con here in the UK, in Birmingham, which was in the middle of the UK. And one of the guys that I beta read for, a chap called Ricky Fleet, he's got three different arcs out, if anybody's interested. But he's a fantastic writer. I've always loved his stuff, and I got beta reading for him. Anyway, Ricky was there. I'd never met him before. I'd always corresponded with him, you know, we'd had chats on Messenger and so on. I made a point of going to see him, and we had a really good chat, really good catch. It was nice to meet him in person, you know, put a proper face to the name. And I sort of floated the idea to him about the Cracklocks, and he basically, the piece of advice he gave to me was, well, if you don't have a go, you'll never know. And it sort of mulled over that a bit. That was sort of in March 2019. And then I mulled over it, and I thought, well, can I do it? Could I actually write a story? And then in May 2019, I sat down and I tried. And what resulted from that, it took me about a year, was a 210K book. It was completely too big. I had no idea what I was doing. But then from that, I was able to talk with Ricky and a few of the other author guys that I know. And they really helped me a lot. And they enabled me to split it down into what became the first two books of my series. So there's book one, Fail Foe, and then there's book two, which is The Lost and the Departed. They actually started as one long story. So that really is the background, is the fact that I didn't like the fairies. I had an idea about what people could do about them. You know, to people who particularly hated fairies. And that's what transpired. That was the end result. I kind of write and always have done for pleasure. It keeps me out of trouble when there's garbage on the TV that my wife watches. And I've done various short stories and things, but this is my first real go at it. When my wife read it, she said, you should publish this. I kind of thought, yeah. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that's really the background to what got me started. So it's only, coming up to the third year of me actually doing it, so.
Well, it's, I have started reading it, and the prose is absolutely beautiful, and your wife was definitely right that it was worthy of getting out there, because it's a unique story, and definitely there's a little bit of satire in there, which I really like as well.
Thank you. That's very kind of.
Since this is the Authors in Focus podcast is really a place where you've got the floor to communicate to our community about your work and why people should be reading your stuff over others. Because as you probably know, there are so many authors out there in speculative fiction. Every time I look, it's like they multiply like gremlins that are fed after midnight, which is an analogy I use quite often, but it's really true. So why don't you tell our community about the Cracklock Saga as a series and why, you know, they should be grabbing it and binging it right now.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, I'm told it's unique by various people who've read it and people who have reviewed it who are completely independent to me. They've said, you know, it's a brand new almost kind of storyline. It's not. I'm not copied really from anybody else. I mean, there's elements in there. I mean, there's some portal stuff in there. There's the fairies and things. I mean, really, this story actually tells is it's the story of the Cracklops, who are a family who hate fairies, and they have been for centuries trying to do their level best to kill them off. That's the main bulk of the family. There is a small arm of the family to which our hero, Jack, belongs. The story starts with him knowing nothing about his legacy or anything like that. He lives with his mum. She's a single parent, and he has no knowledge of the Fae at all or anything associated with that. The reason for that is that he was glamoured at the age of four to hide him from the bad side of the family, who wanted him for some nefarious purposes. The first book really, Fae or Foe, is his coming into what is essentially his legacy. Him learning about who he is, what his capabilities are. The family can see Fae. They can see the fairies due to some twists and turns that happened in their genetics as they went along. They were interbred with fairies over a certain period of years, and it all came to a point, and from that point they could see the Fae themselves. So, yeah, the story is unique from that point because it isn't looking at fairies being all nice and nice. The bad guys in it, the other part of the Cracklock family, are particularly nasty. They kill fairies, basically. That's what they do, and they're looking for a way to do it. And they found a way, finally, to destroy the whole of the fairy realm. And it falls to Jack and his family, his great-aunt Elsie, who comes to essentially educate him, and a few long-time friends of the good side of the Cracklock family, who are Fae, to try and help him understand and to try and put a stop to what they're doing. In book two, I can't really tell you too much without breaking the story, but it's an action adventure all the way in book two, and then in book three we it all goes a little bit foobar. Book three actually comes out at the start of February. So yeah, in a nutshell, that is it. It is a fairy tale, if you like, but it's not a particularly nice fairy tale. It is suitable for young adults and adults alike. Most of my readers are adults. I do have an 8-year-old who's read it, who raved about it, who's bombarded me with questions. So it's kind of suitable for all. There's lots of things in there, magical devices. As I say, there's some portal stuff in there. But the main thing is the development of the characters with their own unique voices and the perils that they face as they go forward.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed when I was reading is that definitely, I don't know if you're familiar with the Lemony Snicket series of unfortunate events.
Yes.
But much like that series, and I'm not saying it's the same, there's kind of a satirical voice that kind of not only, like, it's suitable, like my kids read Unfortunate Events, but there's also a lot of stuff in there that's underlying that adults would be able to appreciate that kids might not necessarily get. And I noticed that in your writing, and that was one of the things I think that really drew me to it, was that it was something that could be appreciated by all ages, but definitely wasn't stereotypically YA.
Yeah. When I rate it, there's no profanity at all in it. It's not because I don't agree with profanity in books. I mean, I'm a Stephen King fan and a James Herbert fan, for goodness sake. But when I rate it, I kind of thought, well, I'd like it to be suitable for all. And if you're F-bombing the whole time, you know, you're kind of pulling part of your audience out. So, yeah, they have their own fairy curses that they use, which I was quite pleased with. So.
Yeah, I'm in a weird situation with my stuff because my first... I now have a 12-part overarching series that are split into three trilogies, and the first one is extremely F-bomby, really very adult, very irreverent, and then I specifically wanted the second trilogy to not have any swearing because it was it started as a bedtime story that I was telling my son for about 6 months, and it was turned into an actual trilogy. And because of that, and because of the genesis of it, I didn't want any swearing, but because it's metatextual stuff, and as I mentioned, I bring James and myself in as characters, we actually establish in story why there's no bad words in the books.
Okay. I must say, I was very intrigued by your series with the house plants.
Okay, yeah, so that is what is... Okay, so we're wrapping up a 12-book overarching series that's been going on for a while, that started with the Cider and Ale Chronicles, and then in February I'm putting out a trilogy called Max and the Captain, And then in the spring, we're putting out a trilogy called The Guardians of the Storyverse, which really ends this entire series, which is three different series, but the characters keep making appearances in all of them. So it's like a big extended world. And I wanted it to end because every time we would finish something, I'd be like, yeah, but we should bring these characters back. And I just wanted it to have an ending. And there was an ending in my mind, and I wanted to move forward and challenge myself with different story ideas. So Alan and the Andersons, which is the story that is going to be from the perspective of a aloe vera plant watching a young couple go through the ups and downs and trials and tribulations of their life, sentient yet silent, was sort of the first idea that I had to step completely outside of this 12-book world and do something that doesn't tie into it whatsoever. And also do something. I mean, all our books have a lot of heart. I tell people, and the reviews have been, I've cried as hard as I've laughed. And that's kind of what we want, because there's a lot of emotion. But this one is going to be probably the first one that will be more emotion and slightly less laughs.
Cool. So we'll certainly be picking it up.
It'll has to be written first. And that will, we write very fast, but that one will be the one that comes out in the early summer. I totally get what you're saying too, about midway through, I was thinking, you know, I would love young people to be able to read some of this stuff and not have their parents take it away.
Yeah. Well, that was the aim with it, because, my daughter was really very keen to read it. And, I was kind of thinking, she's 14 now, so she's at that age where swearing is part of their school culture. When I've written these, I've always sort of had an eye to them being universally acceptable. So,
right. Oh, and that makes perfect sense. What I wanted to ask you, breaking away a little bit from content, is as a self-published author, obviously, you know, as we all know, I'm a self-published author too, and I know many others, there's a little bit of a stigma about self-publishing. It's great that we're able to put our books out and bring them to the world basically at the pace and timing that we want. But there's also the stigma that anybody can put a book out these days. And there are scientific and mathematical ways and understandings to sell large quantities of books, even when your book isn't necessarily a good book. How do you feel about that, about the whole stigma of self-publishing? What has been your biggest joy so far in the entire process? And what have been some of the things that have been a little bit more of a fundamental obstacle or just stumbling block in the process?
Yeah. Personally, I mean, I think self-publishing is a wonderful thing. Like you say, unfortunately, it does enable garbage to seep into the mix, which I think is the kind of thing that's tainted the perception of self-publishers. And the problem is, I think with regards to the traditional publishing route, I mean, you have the big boys who were, you know, the Stoddard Norton, people like that, but they're really only interested in the celebrity market. People have already, you know, either got books out or beat the famous names and so on, so they're quite difficult to crack. The smaller publishing outfits, who are, I think, certainly from the ones that I've had dealings with, do a great job. But it all comes down to the marketing side. Again, in the smaller publishing houses, particularly, you know, you have to do your own marketing. I'm not saying that the bigger guys also say that you need to do some, but they have a bit more clout, whereas the smaller publishing guys, you know, they want you to do a lot more of your own marketing, which, if you're going to have to do that anyway, why not self-publish? Now, from my perspective, I think self-publishing is great, but you've got to get it right. You have to put something out there that's of decent quality, I think, in order to become credible in this market. Because, you know, there are a lot of very poorly written, poorly formatted books out there, you know, that are on particular subjects that people just buy up in droves. So I think there's nothing to stop anybody from self-publishing a decent book now, particularly with regards to the editing that can be done on it, getting yourself a reasonable cover, getting your blurb right. The downside, I think, personally, to the self-publishing is the marketing side. I mean, yeah, there are ways and means. It's a marathon, not a sprint, when it comes to marketing, particularly, you know, for a new author like myself who's only got two books out. It's the marketing side that it's getting to grips with things like, you know, if you're published on Amazon and the Amazon ads and how they all work and so on. And it can be very daunting for people, particularly those that do this essentially on a part-time basis like I do. At the end of the day, I run a business, a reasonably successful one, and this is story writing is something I do to relax in my spare time. So when it comes to publishing, it became a pretty steep learning curve, particularly once writing the book is only about 30% of the battle. It's once you've written it, then that's when you really need to start thinking about what you're going to actually do. You need to put some money away for your marketing and everything else and so on. So my biggest bugbear is the marketing. But to answer your original question is, I think self-publishing is a fantastic opportunity for anybody, but I do think you need to do it right. Do yourself justice. Put something out there that people are going to want to read and actually look at and think, yeah, okay, this reads well. It reads as well as any traditionally published and edited book.
Right. I agree with you. And there are so many, I would say that the only reason I even know about, well, I think I found out about indie books and self-published books, because I did a little research, because I was in a big chain bookstore about 5 years ago looking at the fantasy section, and I happened to see a set of books that were on display, and they were the manager of the store's books. She is a fantasy author, and she had 8 or 9 books that would not normally be in the store, but because she was the manager of the store, she was doing a signing, so she had all of her books up, and I looked at them and I thought, this is really cool. This is engaging. And I actually read one and I thought it was great. And I told her about it and she said she was self-published. And then I found out that there was an entire world, a growing world of amazing authors that were really, really fine-tuning their own stuff and writing excellent, excellent quality work and, you know, excellently edited work. And basically, I would say, now 85 to 90% of what I read is self-published or indie, and I got into it myself. So I definitely agree with you. I think it is amazing. I think it's great to not have to live by a traditional publisher's schedule of putting out a book maybe once a year maximum to every 2 years. It works really well for prolific authors that have a lot of ideas that want to put out, you know, maybe 10 books a year. That's the type of thing that under a traditional system you'd never be able to do.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's a phenomenal opportunity for people to be able to, you know, even just people who want to publish a little book just for their family, you know, some records but want to do it properly. I know there are other ways of getting them published, but you know, you can contract out to local publishers and things to format it and so on. But I think the perception of the self-published industry is going to change. I mean, if you think about it, really, it's still in its infancy compared to traditional publishing routes. You know, some of these publishers have been around for a century and so on, you know, back in sort of pre-Second World War days and so on. Some of them even longer, even further back than that. And self-publishing really has kind of only really become massively available due to some of these bigger multimedia companies now. So I don't know. I read an article probably about 3-4 weeks ago. It was, you know, how traditional publishing seemed to have been seriously starting to think about being threatened by the self-publishing market. Because I, like yourself, I mean, about 85-90% of the books I read are indie published books that I pick up from groups like, you know, Fancy Focus and so on and things like that. I mean, I do still buy, there's a couple of authors I buy. There's obviously James Herbert, Stephen Leather I like, but all the rest of them, they're all kind of indie books. So.
Right. And you got to just look at those sales figures. A lot of times it's the indies that are top of the charts, whereas if a Big Five puts out a fantasy book that isn't, you know, Brandon Sanderson or you know, Ellie Modestit or Robin Hobb or one of those, then, you know, the stores are getting one copy and they're not cracking the top 75,000 on the Amazon charts anyway. Mm-hmm. And whereas indies are often hitting that top 1,000, top 1,500. So, I totally understand why there would be a threat kind of this new wave. And I think a lot of people are out there to kind of at least guide from an aesthetic standpoint, like you said, when it comes to formatting and cover design, and just doing their best to make a create a professional looking project. Just because it's indie doesn't mean that it has to be badly edited and look indie. And I think a lot of people are finally starting to get that.
Mm. The thing to remember is when you're flicking through Amazon looking for a particular type of book or bookbow or anybody like that, is you don't think, oh, is this an indie or a traditional published book? You look at the book cover, oh, that looks okay, what's that about? Oh, you read the blurb, yeah, that looks pretty good, bye. You know, the standard now, the self-published, you know, competes completely with the traditionally published. And that is the reason I think why they are starting to feel threatened now by the indie authors, because the standard is increasing. Yes, and as we've already discussed, there is a lot of junk out there. There really is. But anybody can fix their book if it doesn't look great. So, yeah, I think it's the way forward. And I think as it develops, certainly the self-publishing industry has really, you know, come on in sort of the last 10, 15 years. That's what I found when I was doing my research and deciding whether to go either try to do traditional or go self-publish. And in the end, I thought, well, I can do self-publish because I can get the help to do the bits that I don't know how to do. I'd recommend it as a way forward, really, for anybody who's thinking about publishing. Seriously consider doing it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Shifting gears a little bit, this is something I'm always very curious about because it's something that I employ in my writing. How much of your own personality, character traits, you know, the people in your own life and your personal life, make it into the characters that you write? I know that for myself, I have a hard time not writing myself either literally into the books or having myself be an avatar of a character or making every female MC my wife. It's just something that I'm very guilty of, and I'm trying to sort of broaden my horizons, but I kind of can't get away from it. So I'm always curious when other people are writing, if they end up employing similar tactics.
That is brilliant. Yeah, I in my books, a lot of the characters are based on people that I know. A lot of them are. Some of them are kind of hybrids of people that I know. Others are essentially the people with their names changed. I don't feature in them. My personality doesn't. Me, the way that I do things doesn't appear in them. Probably the one that probably closest to me would be Firmarillion, the Fjorin, but everybody else is pretty much based on people I know, including the bad guys from the Cratlocks. It's from people in the past and so on. So I think as authors, we're probably all guilty of a certain amount of doing just that, of writing people in that we know. At the end of the day, they tell you to write what you know.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, you know, and you know the people who are closest to you, you know, people from your past and so on are ideal characters. And that, at the end of the day, is the wellspring where we kind of get our ideas from. It's our past experiences and so on. And things that you see, you know, if you're out down at the mall or, you know, literally, I get a lot of my ideas when I'm walking the dog. That's when I tend to mull story ideas over. That's when the only time I really get peace and quiet, to be honest with you. So, yeah, I'm guilty of it. I haven't written myself in. I've certainly written a lot of other people in, particularly as we move into book three, Alice and the Mirror Glass. Alice is the name of my daughter, for starters, and she's very much based on my daughter. She's a bit older in Alice and the Mirror Glass than my daughter actually is, but he's in there. And the evil professor who's in there as well is based on my son. I asked him, did he want to be a good guy or a bad guy? And he's 9. He said, I want to be a bad guy, Dad.
Of course he does.
Yeah, fair play. I'll put you in as that then.
Okay. All the boys want to be the bad guys. That's just the way it goes.
Yeah.
My son would have said the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Actually, he made it into, one of our books is kind of meant to be a joke book. It's the 11th book in the series, right before the 12th book, which is where everything really gets super intense. But the 11th book is kind of meant to be like a palate cleanser a little bit. So, it was a story that my son and I actually wrote together. So literally there's a French fry monster with hot dog arms and chicken nugget legs.
That's awesome.
That, that they have to fight, that the main characters have to fight at the end. And that was one of his contributions. And he also named the bad guy the devil's brother, just plain and simple. So I did a lot of research on that, but it ended up becoming, there was a movie called The Devil's Brother, with Laurel and Hardy back in the day. And I ended up, making a whole big thing about how we made a joke out of the devil's brother, who ended up actually being, a demon in our story, that was offended that my son and I made a mockery of him and turned him into a cartoon villain. So the big bad of the entire story is the real devil's brother, like the real demon. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That he's just got a grudge because he's angry that me and my son made a joke out of him, out of his name. So that's the kind of stuff that we do. But yeah, no, that's really cool. It's cool to hear that you do that and that other authors do that as well. And I always like to find out, you know, what their tactics are in coming up with characters. I've had a lot of people, specifically male writers, that write amazing female MCs. And a lot of the times they'll just say, well, I'm not really writing a female necessarily. I'm just writing a person. And I'm trying to be as real as I can with it. And that's kind of what I go for as well. So,
yeah, that's it. I was asked a question in an interview before about, you know, how do I write female characters? I'm like, well, to me, they're just characters. There's no difference. I mean, Elsie in my book, Great Aunt Elsie, has a very distinct personality that's based on somebody that I know. Her humour comes from that person. And I don't have an issue with writing different gender roles and things into the books, because to me, they are just characters. You know, I know how they want them to be.
That's exactly the way I handle it. That's very cool. So this series is the Crackbox Saga is a trilogy, correct? Or are you continuing it?
No, it will be six books, maybe seven. It depends if I can wrap everything up in book six.
The reason I asked that question was because my next question is, what's next? I know that you've got the third book coming out in February, but if we were going to look a little bit into the future, what is next for you over the coming year and a bit?
Okay, I've just finished, just before Christmas, book four, which is called Dire Sorrows. That's going out to my beaters next week, and then it'll go. I do it the opposite way around to some people. I get it beated first, and then it goes to the editor once I've done their comments. And then very often the beaters will say, can I have another look? And they're a good team that I've got. So that's book four, Dire Sorrows. I am 9,000 words into book five, which is called The Coin of the Realms. And then depending on, I'm a bit of a pantser when it comes to writing. I do plot out the sort of where I need to go, but then everything else kind of comes to me while I'm doing it, and I make changes and tweaks as I go along. So my aim is for this particular strand of the Cracklock Saga, which features Jack mainly as the main protagonist, to finish either book six or maybe book seven, depending on how book six goes. Following on from that, I have got already drafted out some of the character backlogs. I want to do Dorcas's story, the brownie. I need to do Firmerillion's as a standalone. I need to do Elsie's story, because she has a kind of a love story, love hate thing with one of the bad guys, Malkiah. I started that one last year. I've done maybe 15,000 words on that. I think that'll be more of a novella. It'll be about 50,000-60,000, that one. So I've got to do that. And then once I've finished those, I'll be starting the Tobias series. Now, Tobias is one of the bad Cracklocks who's kind of turned good. There's a whole reason why the Cracklocks hate the Fae, which becomes apparent in book one, if you read it. I won't spoil the storyline by telling you, but that's the reason why. But he rails against what his mother is teaching them. So he kind of shrugs off his inheritance, goes off and does his own thing, and he hunts dark Fae. So I've got a whole storyline for him. He appeared in a short that I did for a book called Bluebells. He just appeared at the end of that, and all of a sudden I knew exactly who he was, what he was doing, even how he looked. So that will be the next series, will be the Tobias I haven't got a working name for it yet, it's just the Tobias set. So yeah, that's kind of where I am. I need to finish off the Cracklock saga with Jack first of all. So I've just started book 5 now on that. And then there'll be the standalones, and then there'll be the Tobias thing. And then from there, who knows? The world's constantly developing. So we'll see how we go.
Isn't it amazing, though, as a creative, that you're able to, when you have a story and you've got an idea, you can think that far in advance of where you want to go? And I'm sure there's this part of you that's always saying, wow, I really want to get through this so that then I can get to this story, but I've got to focus on this first. And then you're looking 3 years down the road saying, I don't want to wait that long to get the story out because it's all right here, but you still have to think about the whole natural progression and the systematic way of putting things out. And everybody, every creative person, I don't know if everyone, but it's a trend and a thing among creatives to always think that the thing they're working on now is better than what they did before. And a part of that is that there's just a natural evolution and, or mastering of your craft as you move on. But there's also just that excitement of, being able to come up with these great new ideas that you know are just going to grip people.
Completely. To be brutally honest with you, when I finished book three was finished April last year, I wanted to jump straight on and start doing Tobias, and my wife said, no, don't do that, because if you do that, if you pick up any momentum at all with the Cracklock saga, with Jack and things, then people are going to be waiting. So you need to get that done first. And I don't know about you, but I always do as I'm told when my wife tells me to do it.
Exactly. Well, I'm in the same. I was laughing in my head when you said that, because I've had very similar conversations with my wife when she knows that I'm getting all excited about a new thing. She's like, well, you've got to put Max and the Captain out first, because that's probably your most marketable property. And who knows what's going to happen after that? Like, you might want to do more Max and the Captain, because that's what people want. And I'm like, no, but I've got to do this really weird story where there's a planet where everybody's name is Steve, and I bring in references to people that I know named Steve. And she's like, well, that's a little bit weird. I'm like, yeah, but I'm going to do it anyway. But somehow she always ends up winning. And I end up, so because of that, I ended up making the last series, the one that comes out after Max and the Captain, a series that still, in essence, revolves around Max and the Captain as the main characters. But I also threw all these other things in to bring in some of my other creative ideas as well.
Yeah, it sometimes doesn't make me smile when you realize quite how much of a hand on the bridle they have for us when we're writing. But yeah, I think she was definitely right with it, because the idea, I have the whole idea and things, and unfortunately I'm not able to write full time yet. I mean, I'm hoping to be able to start doing it full time in a few years time, but when you have so many ideas, I've got these, she buys me these leather bound books for Christmas, and they're just full of ideas of where things need to go. So if I don't keep anything electronic, I don't know if I'm showing my age here, but I prefer to write it down with a pencil in my book rather than have any of these wonderful story tracking things that people take and use. And I just use that as it becomes almost like a choose your own adventure book, to be honest.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Very, very, very triggering in a good way, because I feel our lives in that sense are kind of parallel. So that's kind of cool. It's always cool to hear those different perspectives when talking to different people about their writing life, which leads me to this question. I am going to ask you to tell everybody where they can find you online. But the first thing I want to ask, which is kind of the way I end off all these interviews, because I think it's just so important, is if you could give one piece of advice to new and aspiring writers, what would it be?
Believe in yourself. Because every new author goes through this, is you, whatever you write, you'll read through it and you'll think, oh God, no, this is awful. You know, nobody's ever going to want to read this, et cetera, et cetera. All I would say to you is just take a step back, read through it, fix the bits that you don't like, and then have another read. And you'll think, yeah, okay, this is looking all right now. and get a second opinion on it, you know, but pick somebody appropriate to do it. You know, if you're writing a young adult one, your great grandmother's not going to want to read it, you know, that sort of thing. So yeah, believe in yourself, really. Don't worry about how you're going to publish and everything. Just get it written, first of all. Get it written so that you like it. And if you like it and you believe in it, it will show through in your writing. That would be my main piece of advice to people.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I waited on my first book for a really long time, and I actually wasn't sure I was going to be able to get through a certain hump of what I called writer's block at the time. And the way I got through it was to contact the person who's now my co-writer, who I knew because I had read a lot of his stuff. And I said, look, can you just help me ghostwrite me through this little hump? And that's what all it was supposed to be, was a ghostwriting session. But he ended up having such a good time that we decided to form an actual writing partnership. That's the only way I've been able to get so many books out, because I'm a slow writer. I think it's really important for writers not to hold themselves to astronomical and unrealistic standards. I mean, everybody's got their own pace too and way of doing things. And, you know, if you write one book, that's amazing, because most people don't do that. The people that say, oh, I can't put out 6 books a year, so I must be doing something wrong. No, you know, you're not doing anything wrong. You're just doing you. And it's more important to focus on getting quality product out and actually, as you said, continually putting something into the writing process to keep it alive, to keep it going, than it is to think about quantity and quantifying numbers of books.
Yeah, I completely with you there. Completely with you, because there is a lot of pressure on people, because you see these people who are pumping out sort of 6-10 books a year and so on. And I always look at them and think, well, how are they doing that? You know, are they they must be a full-time writer in order to do that. And, you know, it can be downheartening for, you know, for guys like me who think, oh yeah, you know, I've managed to get 1 out or 2 out this year. Brilliant, you know, I think I've done it. So it's really refreshing to hear you say that, you know, do you, as you've just said, you know, at the end of the day, that's what you're doing. Don't mind what anybody else is doing. You do what you want to do. You make sure that you get what you're doing as good as you can physically get it. And don't worry about anybody else. Yeah.
Creative people are their own worst critics. I find that. And also, harder on themselves than anyone else. It's, you know, the people that, I mean, before I got into writing for 20 years, I was a musician and I was a songwriter, and songwriters and musicians have that same kind of self-criticism and sort of inner saboteur that just sort of shows up and criticizes everything they do. And the reality is, a lot of people will just think it's cool that you're doing it. So it's really, really important to keep a level head when you're doing this and not to fall into those sabotaging mindsets, and to just do what feels right and to feel it, because nobody's going to, if you're not buying into the work that you're doing and the writing that you're doing, and there's an obvious disconnect and it just feels like you're doing it because you feel obligated to do it, then that's going to come out in the writing and people are going to get that right away.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can't say anything. I'll say anything else. Completely agree with you.
It's been amazing talking to you. It's been a really, really cool conversation, and I'm very much enjoying Fae or Foe so far. And I definitely think, you know, being somebody that is around, I actually included in my list of, I haven't finished, but I've read enough of it to include it in a list of top 10 recommendations for readers of fantasy. And yeah. I definitely think that your work stands out on the high level of what's available right now for indie work. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you online if they want to connect or if they want to find out more about your work?
Okay. Well, firstly, thank you so much for those comments. It's always great to hear somebody who, let's face it, here is a damn good writer, you know, say to somebody like me, you know, that's your work's pretty okay. So thank you so much for that, and thank you as well for allowing me the opportunity to talk to you today. It's been absolutely phenomenal. I am online. I'm in all the normal places. So there's the website, which is www.thecracklocksaga.com. There's a lot of stuff on there. There's a guide to some of the characters who you'll meet in the books, who are in there, some of the bad guys and the good guys. Some reviews on there. People are welcome to sign up to my mailing list from that site as well if they wish. It's fairly easy to do. We're on Facebook, The Cracklock Saga, and likewise we're on Instagram and Twitter, again, The Cracklock Saga. I'm not on Pinterest as of yet. I have been told that I need to get on there, but it's not something I've been able to motivate my sorry ass to do yet. So yeah, but we're in all the usual places. If you look for The Cracklock Saga in Instagram, Facebook, or you know, Twitter or online, you'll find us. And anybody that has any questions, there's emails, email addresses, you can always contact me. As I mentioned earlier, but one of my 8-year-old readers, who's a prolific reader, she's read Lemony Snicket and, you know, The Chronicles of Narnia and all that, and was recommended this book by a friend of mine and bombarded me with questions on the email about all aspects of the book, and then left me an absolutely glowing review. So I can't say further than that, but that's where we are. Just type in The Cracklock Saga, you'll find us.
Awesome. Well, Craig, I wish you a tremendous amount of luck in the completion of the series, and you know, any type of compilations that you do, to trilogies and box sets and stuff like that, which you put out while this series is still going on, and everything that you've got happening in the future, just that you're thinking about story-wise, sounds amazing. So I'm looking forward to staying connected and hearing more and being there as it comes out. All the best.
Thank you. And I say I look forward to continuing our discussions over the coming years. So thank you so much, guys. And as I say, thank you for the opportunity. It's been much appreciated.
All right. Take care.
Cheers.
This has been Authors in Focus. You can find my satirical fantasy novels on Amazon. Need help finding readers? Connect with me on Facebook in the Fantasy Sci-Fi Focus group or at authorsinfocus@gmail.com. You can find more episodes of this podcast at fantasy-focus.com and where your favorite podcasts are hosted.